Sometimes the hardest wounds to heal are the ones we can't see, and sometimes those wounds aren't even our own. Adam Frankel is a former speechwriter for former President Barack Obama, and Adam's grandparents survived the Holocaust, and he says that that trauma was passed on to his mother and then to him in unexpected ways. While working in the White House, Adam discovered a secret that would set him on a path to confront the echoes of the past. And he tells his story in his book, which is called The Survivors, A Story of War, Inheritance and Healing. And Adam Frankel joins us now. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Jesse.
This is not the book you intended to write, but I wonder if it's the book you perhaps needed to write.
It is. That's exactly right. Writing this book helped me process some of the experiences that I had in my life, helped me process the larger story of trauma in my family's experience. As I was living in New York in 2006, not too long before joining the Obama campaign as deputy speechwriter, I learned that my dad is not my biological father, and that this was a secret that my mother kept from me and my dad and our whole family, and a secret that I then felt compelled to keep from my own dad for another almost 10 years. And so as I started grappling with this revelation and truth many years later, and trying to make sense of it and understand how it could have happened and the way my grandparents' experience in the Holocaust, I believe, may have contributed to, my mother's lifelong battles with mental health issues, which may have contributed to this experience. As I started grappling with all of that and tried to grapple with all of that, I found that writing about it enabled me to process it, enabled me to find my way through it and ultimately move forward with my life.
It's a funny word, isn't it? Secrets. It has almost a pejorative meaning. However, for people who've been through the Holocaust, secrets can become important, valuable, even positive things.
Yes, absolutely. I think that secrets are common to many families, not just Holocaust survivor families, not just our Jewish families, but I do feel and believe that, secrets were an important part of how my grandparents survived. And, they had to be very careful about who they trusted at all times to survive every minute, every hour during those years when my grandfather was in concentration camps, ultimately at Dachau, when my grandmother was hiding in the woods of Eastern Europe with members of the Jewish resistance and Russian partisans. These secrets were part of how they survived. They immigrated to the United States with an assumed name that they bought acquired somehow in a displaced persons camp in post-war Germany, and came to this country under that name, raised a family with that name, passed that name on to me as my middle name. That was another secret that my family kept, because they feared that, they would not be able to immigrate to the United States under their true names, because my grandfather had evidently gotten into some trouble with the law in post-war Germany. And yet, in the context of peacetime America, secrets began to play themselves out in different ways in my family. And I think in some sense made my mother, the sort of upbringing of being comfortable with secrets about what her own last name was, made her, I think, in a sense, comfortable with keeping secrets and ultimately comfortable with keeping the secret of my own identity from me.
It's incredible, really, isn't it, that 75 years on from the Holocaust, we're still learning things. Still, you can be surprised by the horror, reading about your grandmother hiding in the walls as Nazis stuck their bayonets through the walls. And then your grandfather, I mean, this is a story I'd never heard. I don't think you had heard it either, that he He was part of Jewish slave labor that they were using to build an underground airport for Hitler.
Yes, I mean, it's a fascinating story that is not has not been widely told about the final months of the war when the Allies were decimating German airplane factories. Hitler decided to relocate the German aircraft manufacturing industry underground. And to do that, he put to work thousands of Jewish slave laborers, established a whole system of subcamps at Dachau called the Kaufring subcamps, to build these huge underground factories camouflaged with bushes and trees so that they would not be, so that aerial surveillance would not detect what they were. And my grandfather was one of the slave laborers who was put to work building these. When I was younger, I'd ask him what he did at Dachau, how he spent his days. And he said, oh, I built an underground airport. I thought he didn't know what he was talking about. You know, I thought, something's getting lost in translation or he's not quite remembering, and as I started doing research on the book, I took him at his word and I started researching it. And that is almost exactly what he did.
So how do you see your grandparents' Holocaust experience manifest itself in your mum and then reverberate in your life?
Well, look, I don't think it's not a direct line. It's not a one-to-one causal relationship. But I strongly believe that my grandparents' experience during the Holocaust contributed to this larger family story. We now know more about trauma, the impact that it can have on us, than we've ever known in history. And we understand it in different ways, and we know about it in different ways. I interview for my book a woman named Dr. Rachel Yehuda at Mount Sinai Hospital and School of Medicine in New York City. And she has done a lot of work for many decades with veterans and others, and is one of the leaders in research in emerging science called epigenetics. And we know that, and the epigenome, I should say, is a layer of information that sits on top of the gene and is subject to external factors, including chronic stress and trauma. And through her research, we know that children of Holocaust survivors are three times as likely to display PTSD as demographically similar Jews whose parents are not Holocaust survivors. We know that children of women who were pregnant at or near Ground Zero on 9/11 display similarly low levels of a stress hormone called cortisol, which is associated with PTSD, as their mothers. So we know that trauma can have a genetic impact. And we also know that the way people process trauma, not just the nature of their experience or its severity, but how they cope with it, how they manage it. Do they talk about it? Do they not talk about it? Does, the way that it informs their parenting styles, the family life that they create, that all of that can contribute as well to, their own children's well-being and whether their children develop mental health issues down the road. It is a new science, and the research is new, but it does speak to the ways in which trauma does not just affect those who directly experience it, but can play itself out for many generations after.
I'm speaking with Adam Frankel, a former speechwriter for President Barack Obama, and he's telling us a bit of his story as told in the book The Survivors, A Story of War, Inheritance and Healing. By the way, your father's family couldn't have been more different, Adam, stable and warm. And was it their influence that set you on the path to being a presidential speechwriter?
It was. My dad's father had been a part-time speechwriter for major progressive leaders in the mid-20th century, people like Adlai Stevenson, who ran for president against Eisenhower, Hubert Humphrey, Robert Kennedy, these sorts of people. And I grew up wanting to very much follow in his footsteps. My great uncle on that side had been a member of the Kennedy administration. And, you know, I think that that is part of why learning that my dad is not my biological father, why that family, my family is not, my blood was so painful to me, because I identified so closely with them, because I drew so much of my identity from them. I sometimes wonder if I hadn't, if I'd wanted to be different from them, felt different from them, whether the revelation would have caused me as much difficulty.
Yeah, and you found out just before joining the Obama campaign as a speechwriter, you write that you, when you found out that your father was not your biological father, that you write, quote, "I had lost the thread of my own narrative." And so how do you do the work required during the campaign and then in the White House without these thoughts about your secret intruding?
Well, I tried my best not to let him intrude. I mean, they would inevitably, invariably come up from time to time, and I felt the toxicity of the secret kind of weighing on me. At one point, I went to see a doctor because I had lumps under my arms, and he said it was because of stress. So there were ways in which it continued to eat at me. But the fact is, working as a speechwriter on a presidential campaign and in the White House is an incredibly demanding job. And it almost allowed me, required me to not focus on all these personal issues. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the bandwidth to focus on them. So, you know, it was almost a very convenient way of avoiding all of this. And it was only a couple years into the White House where the routines, the schedule became just a little bit more predictable, at least a little more predictable than a campaign, that I started trying to grapple with all of this. And that's really when, you know, I had an identity crisis after denying it for a long time and not trying to think about it. I decided to focus on it squarely, and the result was total confusion and pain and lack of understanding about who I was.
At the White House, you became kind of the go-to guy on grief. When there was a tragedy, you were asked to write the speech. And I wonder, is part of what made you so good at what you do is that you're in fact shaped in equal parts by your mum's family and your dad's?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're all a product of that. We're all a product of the nature and the nurture. I certainly think that was true in the case of those kinds of speeches. I mean, I tended to do, in addition to the usual allocation of policy and political speeches, I tended to do eulogies and speeches about civil rights and history and faith, and things that required a sort of moral vocabulary that was a little different from your run-of-the-mill political or policy speech. And I certainly think that my grandparents' experience, what it taught me about the importance of standing up for right and what's right, and standing up against what's wrong, it sort of that family heritage, I think, infused in me a moral compass, and my help on those speeches was in sort of one way for me to express it and contribute, you know, also to President Obama, what I felt was President Obama's moral leadership in the country and the world.
No one, including him, really knew what you were going through at the White House. Does he know now?
You know, he does. I went to see him about a year ago, and he asked what I was up to, and I said, you know, I've been working on a book, and we started talking about it, and I shared this experience, and it was very moving to me because, you know, when I was on his staff, it was all business, you know, virtually all business. I mean, the vast majority of our conversations were all focused on the speech at hand, you know, whatever was required to be done. And this conversation was different. It was much more personal. It was very warm. And he expressed a lot of empathy and interest in what had happened. And, you know, when I told him I was writing a book about intergenerational trauma, he joked, "Sounds like a real beach read."
Such an Obama line, isn't it?
Exactly.
Now, you fell out with your mum, probably understandably, when she told you this secret, that your biological father was not your actual father. I don't know if that's the best way of saying it, but anyway, you stopped talking to her, and your grandfather sensed that something was wrong between you and your mum, your grandfather who'd been through so much himself in the Holocaust, and he asked you to forgive her, even though he didn't quite understand what the fallout was about. I wonder if he, of all people, understood the power of forgiveness more than most.
Yes, you know, I think he probably did. And he was looking out for his daughter. You know, I empathize with it. I mean, it caused a lot of pain. The secret led to a lot of strains in my relationship with my mother and with her whole family, frankly, because, you know, they saw me as mistreating my mother because they didn't understand why I had grown distant from her. Nobody told them. I didn't tell them because I wanted to protect my mom's relationships with them. And none of us told her father for the same reason. Even after her siblings found out, none of us told my grandfather because it seemed like it was too difficult. The man was in his 90s, a Holocaust survivor. Why trouble him with this sort of thing? But as a result, you know, he didn't understand it until his final days. And even in my last real conversation with him before he passed away, he said, "Why aren't you better to your mom? Why aren't you more loyal to her?" So it was tough. That was tough. But I also understand that he was a devoted father who loved me very much, but also cared deeply about his own daughter and worried about her, especially given her history of depression and mental health issues. But the larger story that I try and tell in the book is about the ways in which, you know, that there is such a thing as intergenerational trauma. There's also such a thing, I believe, as intergenerational healing. And I hope that over the course of grappling with these issues in my family, I've helped contribute some healing to the family as well.
You write extremely movingly about telling your father for the first time the secret. And I think it took 10 years. That's a heck of a secret to hold on to for 10 years. But you decided to tell him. Why did you decide to tell him, and how did it go?
Well, I decided to tell him because after many years, I was in a place where I could recognize that my only way through this whole thing was to tell him that the secret had taken such a toll on me, on my relationships with my mother's family, and also with my dad and his family. I mean, I didn't feel like I could be honest. I was being honest with them because I wasn't. There was this profound secret that I was withholding from them, that was very personal to my dad. And so I came to understand that in order to move forward with my life, a first important step was actually being honest with him. So, I called him up and told him I needed to come see him and talk about something. And when I got to his home, you know, I just launched into it. I said, you know, you remember some years ago, I told you my relationship with my mother was strained. He said, yes. And I said, well, what I didn't share was that the reason, for a lot of those difficulties was because she told me that I'm, you know, not your biological son. And I told him who my mother told me was my biological father, which was a man that I've known all my life, who my father knew as a presence in my life growing up. And I'm crying. I'm bawling this whole time. I can barely get the words out as I'm sharing this with my dad. And through the tears, I hear him say, I know. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing him say. I said, you know, what do you mean, you know? And he said, Adam, I've always known it was possible. And I made a decision a long time ago that it doesn't matter one way or another, you're my son, and you always will be. And I, you know, I was just, I couldn't believe it. And I went up and hugged him very tightly for a long time. And then we had an open and honest conversation about it. And it was, you know, he shared with me why he'd had his doubts over time. And I began the process of healing and began the process of sort of looking back and realizing the sort of shadow biography that I'd had, this information that my dad had even had that he'd kept, you know, he'd considered a paternity test at one point, but decided against it. You know, there are all kinds of other things that made me look back and see my life entirely differently.
And your book begins with a T.S. Eliot quote, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." Great quote, by the way. And do you feel that you've arrived where you needed to get to?
I do. I do. I think, you know, I needed to go on this journey. I needed to write this book. And I should say, you know, part of the reason I wrote it was not just for my own healing, but for others too, because there is an explosion of revelations, of family disclosures like this due to at-home DNA kits. And when I was going through all of this, I couldn't find examples of other people who had experienced something similar. In fact, one of the very few places where I was able to find instances was in Australia, where there had been, some research done on what are called late discovery adoptees and late discovery donor conceived children, whose emotional journey and psychological journey I felt seemed very familiar to me. And I could recognize in testimonials, including a dissertation I tracked down by an Australian researcher named Helen Riley. In testimonials of late discovery adoptees and donor conceived children, I, for the first time, felt like I wasn't alone. There were people who had experienced something similar. And so one of my hopes with the book is to show people that there is a path through this, even though it may not feel like there is all the time, and to show people who are experiencing other forms of familial trauma and pain, that, you know, there is a way forward if we can grapple with that legacy of intergenerational trauma.
Well done. The book is called The Survivors, A Story of War, Inheritance and Healing. And Adam Frankel, we really appreciate you sharing your story and spending some time with us today.
Thanks so much, Jesse.